Jason Craig is a man who I've known for many years. We've never met in person, but the organization that he's a part of, Fraternus, as I've always saw, is this great compliment in a good way, not in a negative way. Great compliment to what we're doing at the Kingsmen. We form men at the Kingsmen, just in manliness, and then Fraternus becomes this organization that then puts them into a pipeline whereby they can receive training as mentors of young boys. So it's like we get the men excited about being a man, and then we can turn them over to Fraternus to now take the next step in the formation of other men. I just thought it was awesome. So we've always had Fraternus as part of our Into the Wild offering, and people would say, and the misunderstanding is that it's just for young boys. Although it is for young boys, it's really about activating men. I won't take from his presentation in the role of forming a young boy. So when it came to me, Philip said to me, we want to do mentoring. Mentoring is a key. I said, I know the guy. I know the guy that has to speak on mentoring. It's Jason Craig. And so we called Jason. And the funny thing about Jason is when you email Jason, he's a farmer, he's a dairy farmer. And, you email Jason, if you don't hear from Jason, for a couple months, you're like, that email didn't hit the mark with Jason. Okay, so, or if you call Jason, you don't hear from a couple months, it's just the sense of urgency wasn't in there. So I knew we had Jason's interest because I emailed him about this, and within a day, maybe even hours, I got a response saying, I'm interested in coming to this. So I knew we touched on something with Jason that said he was excited, and I'm excited to hear what he's going to share with us. So our friend Jason Craig from Fraternus and North Carolina, thank you for being a part of Masculine Genius.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm happy to be the delegation from below the Mason-Dixon line. My wife said, how's it going? And I said, I don't know. They put me in a truck with a Yankee from New Jersey and with Bob Dylan all over the car. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. But no, it's been good. We forgive you for burning Atlanta. Don't worry. We're over that. We built a great airport for you. Somebody even says, I was talking to someone, we're here in North Carolina a lot because we're going there. I'm like, yeah, our immigration problem is from the north. I grew up in a high school where everyone had bumper stickers. It was, which by the way, my introduction to Catholics was, Catholics were the Yankees that didn't go to church. That was, because it was their excuse on like not doing kind of typical Southern Christian things was, well, I'm a Catholic. It's like, I guess that means you don't go to church. Okay, well, I'm a Catholic now, don't worry. But anyway, I'm happy to be here. Yes, I want to talk. I have been enamored with trying to understand Fraternus, this apostolate I kind of fell into through circumstances, and it's worked really well. And part of my presentation today is me wrestling intellectually, even going to get my master's and trying to wrap my mind around sort of why Fraternus was working. And the reason is that I was trained as a Protestant and even early as a Catholic in youth ministry. And we started this thing of Fraternus, and the men were doing everything wrong when it comes to traditional practices of youth ministry. We did all sorts of things that don't make sense. First of all, the dads were invited. Second of all, we had middle school and high school and granddad all together in one room. And then we had this amazing success kind of doing what is not traditionally done, which is what we do in the church now is imitating secular education, which is we think of things in data. We need to get data into the computers of the persons. So we divide them into the most efficient parts, high school over here, middle school over here, young adults over here, young adults unmarried, young adults married, and just ad nauseum. So we just put them all in a room and started over. And it worked. In some places, like the Diocese of Nashville, our recent summer camp, the vocations director came. He said, well, I feel like I need to come because 15 of our seminarians came out of Fraternus. So when you start getting those kind of vocation numbers, you start to get attention. And that's who, really, we don't dwell well in typical circles of youth ministry because we really don't work with youth directly. We work with men and teach them how to be mentors. And surprise, surprise, it's effective. So this is my sort of understanding, and I think I was assigned the task of It was a transforming effect or life-changing effect of mentorship. I think it's very important that we put some theological, anthropological, and practical flesh on those bones, because the world could use the same language to mean something totally different than what we mean. And mentorship is not a Christian word. It's a Greek word, comes from mentor, who was supposed to take care of Telemachus while Odysseus was gone, right, at war. And mentor was supposed to take care of him. It's very questionable whether he did or not, because actually Telemachus was completely dominated by the suitors, remember, who were after Penelope. And Telemachus was completely emasculated by all the men around him. His mother had no idea how to form him because his father was gone. And it was not until, actually, ironically, a female goddess entered his life, but she disguised herself as mentor. Because even a goddess knew, you can't go to a boy as a woman, even a goddess, and pull him out of his emasculated adolescent stupor. I have to cloak myself in the image of mentor. So mentor comes to Telemachus, gets his butt out of the house, sends him on a journey to understand better who his father is. He comes back. His father ends up coming back, and together they kill all the suitors. And it's the most glorious moment in all of classical literature, when Odysseus locks the door, and I believe the first is the, speaking of combat, of the throwing a spear through the throat of one of the suitors. So that we're getting a little violent there. But that's where the word comes from. It's popularized because Father Fenelon, a French kind of mystic and writer, started using it in the context of sort of a formational teaching. And it's mostly been picked up in the secular world, the idea of mentorship, that, hey, people aren't machines, because we live in the era of machines. People aren't machines. They actually need some sort of human accompaniment. So mentor starts becoming the word we use today. So I want to make sure that we don't use vague, I don't want to be some sort of vague expert using secular terms to describe what you already know, which is boys need men in their lives. We already know that. We could stop right there. What do they do? Lots of things. From handshakes to opening doors to standing. Okay, so let's take mentoring and really orient it towards something concrete and understand it. To do that, I always like to frame it in the framework of a rite of passage. The problem when we discuss rites of passage that I have found is people don't actually know where the word come from. It is not a Catholic word, although it is rites of passage, R-I-T-E. And they tend to focus on the rite itself, meaning the initiation ceremony. That's kind of what's sensational about the idea of a rite of passage. Some boy's killing a lion or hanging from hooks on his back or putting a glove of like flesh-eating ants on for some reason. And they only focus on that. But the rite of passage is actually, it comes from a secular sort of anthropologist before there was anthropology by the name of Arnold von Gennep. And what he recognized is that in societies, healthy cultures always found ways to help individuals transition from one form of life to another form of life. And the reason the rite of passage was necessary is that those two forms of life cannot coexist. If they can coexist, you don't need a rite of passage, okay? So let's not go inventing rites of passage for all sorts of unnecessary reasons. The necessary reason of rite of passage is when two forms of life cannot coexist. So we need to have a moment, but also moments on both sides where there's a transition that's made. So he recognized, and he didn't speak primarily of adolescent rite of passage. I'll talk about why that's all in our mind. We tend to only think of boys becoming men. When I say rite of passage, no one in here thought of baptism, marriage, death. But we'll talk. So he recognized that in all cultures, in all rites of passage, there are three stages. The first stage, and if you're going to write anything down, these are the three things. And I think they'll help us understand when we're mentoring, what are we doing? This is what we're doing as men. The first stage, but let's talk about it universally first. The first stage is a separation from the former life. In a sense, a death of that life. So you can put separation / death. You got to separate from that stage. The second stage, he called it transition or initiation. This is typically what we only talk about. We get in circular conversations about how we can kill lions even though we don't know how to shoot a gun or we don't have any lions, you know. The third is, and please put a star by this one, incorporation. And let me just, we're going to get quick geeky Latin. In corpus is to be brought into a body. So when I say incorporation, don't think business, think body. What is the body that is being incorporated into? So here's an example. You know, rites of passage, and by the way, when we, just like I told that story of Telemachus and Odysseus, once you hear these, you will see them everywhere. I just read Captain's Courageous again by Kipling. There it was, plain as day. I read Little Britches, classic kids book with my kids. There it is right there. It's in Lord of the Rings. It's in Star Wars. A rite of passage is in every great epic literary expression because literature often says what the philosophers and the theologians can't. It tells it in stories in ways that we can grasp, and this is why it's very important for you to be reading stories to your children. And that'll be, you know, they need you to read Lord of the Rings. I love drilling them about the Trinity too, but we need to read some really good books with them too. So but I hope you recognize these stages. So the one where you definitely recognize it, most of us will, is in marriage. So in Genesis and in Luke, when Jesus repeats it, marriage, for this reason, a man must leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, so that the two can be one flesh, in corpus, one body. The reason he has to leave his father and mother is that he cannot simultaneously be in their household as a son and be a husband and father at the same time. He can't. So he has to separate from them. Then we have the initiation of the wedding itself, where we mark the moment when everything changes. But it doesn't end there, and that's where most people get hung up. It doesn't end there. We know that young couples need an ongoing incorporation, not only into themselves as the body amongst themselves, but also in a community that of other married people. They need that mentorship there too, right? So this rite of passage, you got to be separated, you got to be initiated, you got to be incorporated. It's all over the place. And I've got lots of examples, but I'm the guy that got stuck right before lunch. So I'm going to skip them and go right to the boy. What is it for the state of a boy? What is his rite of passage? And again, I want, if you from now on after this talk, when you hear language of rites of passage, never consider it only the second stage, initiation. Do not think of it on, you have to, von Ganep never understood it as only the second step. It was a cohesive whole, right? And we need to understand it as a whole or it's incomplete. And we'll get talking about esoteric and exotic initiations without understanding what's really happening. So if in a boy's life, first of all, why, when we say rite of passage, why do boys like own that reality? One, because girls and women, not the same thing, they have within their body physical changes that makes it obvious that new states of life has occurred, i.e. menstruation, childbirth. When a woman endures the ordeal of childbirth, she has endured the ordeal of a natural implanted rite of passage. Her prior state of life was a woman. After the initiation, she is a mother. Those two realities cannot exist at the same time. She is one or the other. Obviously, as a mother, she's still a woman. But you ask a woman who's had a baby, she is always a mother. Mary kept these things in her heart. She's always a mother, always maternal once she's made that shift. And the orientation towards that shift is in her body and menstruation from around adolescence. This is why if you experience, you know, young couples and they get pregnant and the teenage girl has a baby and she all of a sudden matures and is like taking care of the baby. And the son and the boy is off still being a boy. He has not endured any sort of ordeal. He has not been showed. He can't be showed by her how to now be a father. So he keeps being a boy and she ends up maturing and taking care of the baby. And then we got fatherless, this perpetuation of fatherlessness. Women do it more naturally. This is why, for example, we're kind of fascinated, adolescent circumcision. Someone says if ancient cultures were like, well, she's bleeding from there, and so are you. That's going to mark your moment when you're going to recognize that things are different now, okay? The other reason it's so important boys' rites of passage is that if they don't go through it, it is so debilitating. You're absolutely right. It is a building on sonship. You cannot be a brother. As brothers, we recognize a mutual father. That's what makes us brothers, i.e. it presupposes that I recognize myself as a son. Of course, brotherhood builds on sonship. And then, of course, if we recognize the fatherhood and then as brothers we're brought into that, then we know how to love sons because we've been one. So, of course, sonship matters. If you get, and the interesting thing, the classicist Alan Bloom points this out really beautifully, is in all other species and creatures, puberty is the end of development. Now that you can mate, we're kind of done. You've been growing into that point. We have a bull calf on our farm right now, and he is getting more and more aggressive. And for him, he is going to grow naturally into his puberty, and then he's going to become a jerk because Jersey cows are mean. And but he doesn't know I have these little clamps in the cabinet. They're going to take care of that really quick. So with a lot of animals in husbandry and farming, you actually intentionally reverse maturity so that you know, the word steer, I don't know if you, the word steer means a castrated bull, you know. So people talk about steers as if like, hey, he's like a wild steer. You don't know what that means, obviously. Sorry, Yankees. But if the reason it's so in our imagination as boys is that if boys don't achieve this, they become either, and this is a spectrum, so I'm going to say yes, of course, there's both ands. They either become passive, which I think when he says sensitive and creative, I actually consider myself much more of an artist than an engineer. I like writing. I like poetry. I like to read. I like silence. I tend towards nonviolence. Don't tell Dr. Schaff this. I am willing to fight. I have guns. My children have seen me burst out of the house and shoot things, not people. And, you know, things killing chickens. It's, you know, so we have no problem with, but anyway, I tend towards that. But I've had the blessing of a good father who that does not become the I think passivity is the issue that can happen if a boy doesn't receive a rite of passage. The other side is aggression. When you hear there's been a mass shooting, do you ever think, oh, I wonder what little girl did that? Right? You never do, because you know that violence is not a human problem. Violence is a male problem. And if a male has not received his security as a male, he is trying to prove it. So if you don't realize that masculinity is by giving your life, then what you do is you try to imitate masculinity by taking life, i.e. you become violent. Or passive. I don't understand my own security and masculinity, but he does, so I kind of passively place myself under his wing. Or an even worse mutilation, I place myself under the passive wing of my wife. Which is a, you know, this is a temptation. And then there's a temptation for me from the very beginning. Your desire shall be for him. Right before Eve gets the curse. Your desire shall be for him, but you will be under him, under his rule. We know what your desire, that means later in Genesis, because God uses it when he's appealing to Cain. Sin is at your door. Its desire is for you, i.e. to dominate you. So when a woman's desire to dominate, it's part of the fall. But God reaffirms the order of creation, which is he shall still rule over you. There's going to be tension, but he shall rule over you. Part warning, part commandment. Okay, so what are the stages? How do we correspond these stages to boys? Now that we understand boys, they're either going to be passive, they're going to be aggressive, they're going to be passive-aggressive. There's going to be these deficiencies if they don't receive the security of initiation. What are the stages for a boy? And this is where, just let me pause, it came up a lot in our conversation. One thing that fascinates me is that traditional societies, i.e. societies based on patrimony and those specifically tied to some sort of agrarian culture, do not have teenage problems. There's not a problem with teenage boys. The Amish very rarely have rebellious teenage boys. The Africans with tribal mentalities, they don't even have adolescence. Because most societies ended adolescence as soon as possible because it's an incomplete stage of life. It's oriented towards adulthood, towards manhood. Why would we leave them in there? Now, our society is, I will never forget when at Obama's first campaign as a millennial, on the Gen X side of millennial, but a millennial, I remember when he said, and you're going to be able to be, this was at a campaign rally at a college, you're going to be able to be on your parents' insurance till you're 26. And everyone went nuts. And I thought, we've lost. It's over. My generation is awful. We're the worst. Sorry, I got lost. Okay. We're perpetuating adolescence where most cultures sever it. And the thing we're dealing with is the industrialized technological world. Because the reality within our bodies, you mentioned over and over, you're obviously mentioning the tension we live in, which is between the spiritual and the natural. And you're trying to reunite them. The problem is the modern age has divided them. That's why we got to talk about it. The great thing about my farm is there is thresholds of obvious masculinity. My wife is not good at pulling a crosscut saw or chopping wood or wrestling down a bull calf so that we may sever his nuts and he'll stop being a jerk, right? She can't. She physically is not good at that. I am physically not good. Mark, you were recording.
I'm sorry.
Edit.
I didn't think nuts would be at the mass contingency.
Excuse me. We are castrating the bull's testicles so that he will be gentler and more passive. And he will be able to be basically a female cow. We'll put her with, that's what you do. You can't put a bull with females until, anyway. Where were we, Mark? Thanks.
Your boy better at things.
Yes, yes. That the reality of our difference is there and it's present in a way that is much simpler. There are thresholds that only I can go in. In the milking parlor, when Dorothy, who is our aggressive milk, she is kind of taking the place of the bull. We call her Testy Teats. When I go in with her, there is no child in there and there is no woman in there until she's a little, she'll calm down as she gets older. Her mother was the same way. She'll calm down. But no one's in there because I am the one to be sent in and be kicked. I'm physically able to endure and subdue that reality. My wife and my children are no help. In the industrialized technological world, and this was the original, you know, the men and the women became leveled out because the work did not become distinctly based on the obvious physical nature of the person. And we tried our hardest to get children out of the hands of the mother into the hands of the state. Horrible mistake. That's why the nanny state, you know, that takes care. It's a feminine reality that's trying to take care of the children in a way that's not the mother. It's not a maternal state. It's a nanny state. So in the technological age, the industrial, you know, basically this battle between the industrial order and the order of the family has been at odds for a long time because once they figured out, oh, a woman can pull the lever cheaper than a man can pull the lever and it doesn't really require his strength. That's been in tension ever since. And now that we live in a very data-driven economy where we're just trading it, no one's actually making anything, we're just exchanging information for profit and trying to manipulate the masses into consuming goods that no one actually made. They were made in factories across the world and shipped over here. There's no craftsmen, there's no need for a body at all. It's very hard to understand our differences. So I can hire someone, I and fraternities can still hire someone, secretarial work, and that there's very often men and women can be paid the same in that same, or whatever. So we're dealing with a disrupted order. As that rises, we get things like even the scouting movement, some people argue, is the fact that men began in industrialization losing the means of connecting with their sons, so we had to sort of manufacture and invent new ways to connect because the old order of things was breaking down very fast, and we're just on the far end of the order breaking down. In the original, if you want to write down a book, it's great. It just lays this out. From Cottage to Workstation by Alan Carlson. You know, he traces the original union movements were very much union movements to get a just wage to the father and get people to stop hiring women. In the South, we have a phrase called go-getter. You know, he's a real go-getter. I actually did the research on it. That phrase comes from when, after we were subdued by the Yankees and humiliated, the bankers from the North came in and industrialized. The South was an agrarian society, primarily, obviously based off the huge abuse of slavery. I don't mean to keep, skirting past the major issue. When the South began being industrialized by the North and capital became flowing in and they started with a lot of the factories and the mills, they realized they could hire the women and the men were complete. They were sitting at the end and they'd sit around all day and go, well, I guess it's time to go get her. So people would say it was originally a insult. He's just a go getter. He sits around waiting to go get his wife at the end of the day. So tidbit, not in the notes, wasting time. Let's move on. All right. So what are the stages for a rite of passage for a boy? One, he must be separated from his boyhood. I love the connection St. Paul makes in his famous 1 Corinthians 13. Love is this, love is that. It's a beautiful, he connects love right after that. People don't keep reading. He connects it with his masculinity. To love is to be masculine. And he says, when I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. Sounds reasonable. I was a child, so I acted like one. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. St. Paul was a Jewish man. They had rites of passage. They had clear things that children did and men did. And when he became a man, he stopped doing the things that boys did. So the first stage in a separation of a rite of passage is that you are separated from boyhood in some way. What this traditionally means is a separation, an intentional separation from the realm and control of the mothers. See, before a boy makes his rite of passage, before he transitions to the men, he's actually sort of a genderless human. We always say women and children. We don't say women, men, and boys. Because men, so we see women and children as the embodiment of the hope of who we are. They have a future. They have a hope within them. Men from that body of women and children are brought out of it, separated out so that they can sacrifice. It's a priestly reality. Just as priests are now separated out of the body, this is why priesthood is masculine, because it's in our very, priests are men because only men can be priests. We get in this argument about, why can only priests have to be men? Because a man has to be a priest. It's in the definition of manhood. Because just like a priest is separated out to offer the sacrifice on the altar, a man is separated out from the body of women and children, so to be a man. This is why in war, when a soldier dies, it's a casualty. When women and children die, it's murder. They ought not be sacrificed. Period. They ought not be sacrificed. We as men know intuitively, universally, unless you're a completely barbaric tribe or race, that you do not kill women and children because they're not the enemy. Unless you're completely callous, completely overwhelmed by the demons that often fuel things on the battlefield, and you start going after women and children. That's the moment you've done something really evil. You know, the burning Atlanta thing. So, in war, there is something wrong about going after women and children because men are separated out because they're dispensable. Within them, I can come back and I can plant the seed again and renew it, but the promise is held within the tabernacle of women. We do not walk around as walking, you know, sort of embodiments of future hope. We walk around ready at any moment. If someone were to come in this room and every man in this room doesn't stand up to protect you, the only female in here, what an awful problem we would have. I love when we have fraternist gatherings and we bring all the boys together. I like to bring my wife and my children actually in the room for them to see. And say, if you guys wouldn't die for them right now, you have yet to understand masculinity. And we live in an age now in the most disgusting, distorted thing that could ever happen with masculinity is for men to actually accept the reality of abortion, and instead of being on the front lines of dying for the sake of the child, to actually put the child on the front line so that they can die for them. There is not a worse example of the distortion of masculinity than men accepting the reality of abortion in their own country. I hear you're not willing to fight. Well, of course we're not willing to fight. We're willing to kill our children before anyone's even here. There's not even an enemy on our shore, and we're killing our children for myself. Of course I can't fight. I have no patrimony. I have no patriotism. I got nothing because I have no patries. I have no father. I'm willing to sacrifice the children, not sacrifice for them. So the boys are separated out of their childhood, separate at first stage, and separated out of the control of the mother. Then they go through the initiation. And I'm gonna skip this part mostly. I just want to make a few comments. Yes, it's normally public. In front of the men, it's a recognizable moment, and it's usually painful, some sort of endurance, and it's hard. The reason is that when the boy is separated out, he comes with an ego, a potential ego that later, when he's incorporated into a body, it's got to go. So there is a certain killing of the ego that is represented in the endurance of the pain in initiation. The point of initiation is not just, there is a certain thing about grittiness. Because the boy is actually unaware of what he's capable of. He's been a boy his whole life. He's never been a man. He's growing into this new male body. He needs to be shown what it's capable of so that he doesn't roll around on the ground like a soccer player when he stubs his toe, right? He needs to know what he's able to endure so that when the sacrifice comes, he's aware of it. So that point, also, there's something about revealing the identity to a man after he endures something painful and difficult that's powerful. Jacob wrestles with God, right? He's wrestling with God. This is going on and on and on. God's not wrestling. gone. You know, God's not actually wrestling. He's helping Jacob wrestle. Then he breaks his leg. This is a really mysterious moment. But if you understand a rite of passage, it kind of makes sense. Then he breaks his leg, the super painful thing that he will now have for the rest of his life to remind him. You know, it says he walked with a limp. Remind him of. And then he changes his name to Israel. He gets a name change. You've got a whole new identity now. So Abraham has to endure circumcision, painful circumcision, gets a new name. Abram, now you're Abraham. Saint Saul gets knocked off a horse and stricken blind. Then he gets a new name, Paul. There's something about enduring a hardship and then receiving an identity that's important. This is who you are. You didn't know you were capable of. I did know you were capable of it. That's why I, too, will give you a new identity. Before you were a boy, now you are a man. You know, before you were Saul, now you are Paul. Before you were this, now you are that. All right. So the initiation, the point is to reveal identity, to kill the ego, and to reveal the grit that he's actually got within him that he doesn't know. Again, we are introducing a boy to a new reality. Oh, because earlier I didn't complete the quote from Alan Bloom is that all creatures, they end at puberty. That's where we begin the building of who they're going to be for the rest of their life. So the animals end when they're able to mate. But now with the extension of adolescence, we're basically, you know, the ability to mate is all we, you know, that's all they have, you know, they have. All right, so the last stage is incorporation, in corpus. You can't kill the individual's ego and then bring him into the nothingness of individuality. We are a body. The church is a body, right? You cannot understand the church as a collection of individuals. I come from Protestantism. I know what a collection of individuals looks like. It looks like if I don't want to go to church and I'm going to read my Bible on the back porch and drink a beer, that's church. Sovereign is he who makes the exception, right? I'm sovereign because I can make an exception of going to church. We're Catholics. It is a mortal sin to miss Mass once. And it's not just because you as an individual really need the Eucharist. It's because, one, you have to worship God in justice, spirit, and truth. But also, if you fall away from the body, you're going to die. A coal that falls out of the fire gets cold quick, okay? You cannot understand your Christian life without understanding the body. I love 1 John. You know, the transition in Christianity is from death to life. There's more to it, but that's very simple, from death to life. And St. John says, this is how we know we have passed from death into life. This is 1 John 3. Here it comes. Should have marked it. Don't judge me. Here it comes. 1 John 3:14. We know we have passed out of death into life because we love the brethren. Our identification with a body is what makes us not the individuals. Because remember, we're separated out of the body of the women and children, but we're joined into another body. So we see the logic of this in all sorts of things. Why do sports teams haze new members? Because you're coming in as an individual. We all have to endure a physical killing of the ego. I'm not saying this is healthy. I'm just saying there's a logic behind what men do. We have to kill the ego so you can be a part of this body. You cannot come in here as an individual. You've got to endure that. You've got to do it too. Why do fraternities haze new members? Because we're a fraternity. You can't come in here with your individualist attitude. So I'm going to pummel you, put you into a coma of drunkenness, literally. And this is an abuse. I'm not proposing this. I'm just pointing out the logic and what they're doing. I'm going to make you drink until you pass out, so that when you wake up, you're resurrected and you're one of us. The individual died in its drunken, punched stupor, right? You have to endure something. Do you see the logic behind this? I mean, men, this is what we do. Again, I'm not proposing. I'm just looking at these things. In the military, you go through boot camp. Why? Because you can't come into this unit as an individual because I depend on you. So brotherhood is not that we as individuals have mutually decided to have shared experiences and loves. How lame is that? I'm not interested in being a part of that. I'm not interested in being a part of something where we as individuals come together for fat pensions, right? What a horrible motivation. I am here to die for you and you're here to die for me. And we both have to know that. So to know that, we're going to endure the death of our individual egos so that when we emerge on the outside on the battlefield, you know I will die for you and vice versa. This makes sense. You see the logic now? It's going to be everywhere. I hope you see it just all over the place. And you hear it on the news and NPR is all confused, and you've got more wisdom than they do, just from, you know, some little classical history. So the last stage is the incorporation. I have 15 minutes. So I want to point out our two greatest challenges if we're going to bring boys into maturity. And in the question and answer, we can talk about how this happens in fraternities or how it could happen in your state or in your situation. But the reality is that as culture has been annihilated by industrialization and homogenization in sort of fashionable media, the way we all, like everyone knows who Lady Gaga is at the exact same moment. Everyone is using fidget spinners at the same time. Which I hope you're not using a fidget spinner. This childish, smack it out of a man's hand if I see it. Put away the things of a child, boy. We don't have our local cultures anymore. I am blessed. I'm going to say in the South, there is a strong identity as being a Southerner and you're tied to your local town. It's been in the news a lot lately, post-Trump election, where a lot of people, National Review, sort of famous pro-market, right-wing capitalist, publications that come from what I would say more of the Ivy League conservative movement are having trouble understanding, like Appalachia, why aren't you leaving where you are? It's depressed. There is no economy. Why not go to the city? And they would sit there and say, I'd rather die. This is who I am. They don't understand themselves outside of their lived culture. Now, let me not romanticize it. We're not. But I will say the friends that I have in this area, we have a coherent view of ourselves as Southern men with particular ways of speaking, with particular ways of living, with particular ways of dressing, with particular things that are acceptable and unacceptable, with an identity. And that's helpful. And that's the reason we actually moved. We were from North Carolina, but we moved to the only county in the state that has no box stores. There's no strip malls. And it's not a totally agrarian culture, and we're being completely consumed right now by Equestrian Center from New York. But they're still a cohesive. So what it looks like for you is not what it looks like for me. You don't have a threshold of a barn. I do. But you do have to have thresholds of masculinity. It's harder when we don't have an inherited culture because we are in the extremely awkward position of manufacturing patrimony, which is a huge problem that no man has ever had to face in the way we as modern men have to face. Even within the church, we are confused at who we are and what it means to be a Catholic. For me, and actually in the South, we have a vibrant Catholic convert, because Protestantism ultimately, as one Southern intellectual that I love to read, he said, it seems that the history of Protestantism proves it is ultimately doomed, and the history of Catholicism is it ultimately blessed. And what he meant was Catholicism knows itself as a body that is a cohesiveness, whereas Protestantism will always tend towards individuality, which dissolves social bonds, which we necessarily need to have this incorporation, right? So our biggest challenge is not the initiation ceremony. It's not killing lions. Our biggest challenge, the first one, is the separation from the realm of the mother, because the mother controls everything in society right now, and the father has been relegated to the village idiot. And that has, I think it's actually exaggerated within the church that men have had a hard time relating to a church that is run by primarily celibate men and women. 85% of church positions are filled by women. The predominance of teachers, both in private, Catholic, public, and even religious education, the overwhelming majority of teachers, even for adolescent boys, are women. The fact of the matter is a woman cannot show a boy how to be a man because she is not one. You cannot give what you do not have, and masculinity is more caught than, it's not a series of points that a woman could put on a PowerPoint and present. It's something that's imbibed by as you're incorporated into the body of men. Women cannot do this. It's not that they're deficient, it's that they never had it in the first place. They never were meant to. And what a horrible burden it would be. We won't get into that. This is great in classic country music, Mama Tried. My dad left and she tried to make me a man. Mama tried, but now I'm in jail. And the frustration of boys is always tied to the mother when he's a follower situation. The great, one of the famous lines in the boys will tend towards either being passive or aggressive, and they'll relate it to their mother oftentimes. When I was just a baby, my mom, if you know the poet, you can let me know if you know it. First one to know it wins. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy. Don't ever play with guns. So I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. Johnny Cash. It's a famous line. There's always a tie to an act of violence in the mother. Or Bohemian Rhapsody. Mama just
killed a man.
Why is he tying it to the mother? Am I a man yet, Mom? She can't tell you that. But I just killed a man. That's, you know, that's not it, you know. The connection and then male aggression towards women as they get more and more angry with the fact that the woman cannot affirm and confer their masculinity. I think definitely inner city hip hop music is definitely ego inflating, flagrant ego inflation. I am the best is basically the summary of most rap songs. And I own all women. So there's a tie to I have to say who I am, because it's a prime, it's a, especially in minorities, a fatherless culture. I actually grew up, I was the only white kid in my neighborhoods until I was about 12. And then the other kid was Chet. You can guess by his name, he wasn't much help for me. So I got beat up a lot. But I also had a lot of friends. And I can tell you, I did not have one friend who was an African American that had a father. Not one. They all lived with grandma, auntie, every single one of them. So it makes sense to me. When you see inner city riots, we should not think, wow, look at them burning their neighborhoods. They're mad at the cops. They need to respect law enforcement. Let me get this straight. You want them to respect an image of authority that comes and goes and condemns them when they do something wrong and rarely is there to praise them when they do something right. That's a father issue we've got going there. So, our greatest challenge is the separation from the realm of the mother, because we have a predominance of women leading every stage, and then they go into the college, which is one gigantic womb. The college is more and more comfortable. The snowflake phenomenon makes total sense. There is an unwillingness to subject them to the endurance of difficulty, whether that's intellectual, physical, moral. There's an unwillingness to challenge. And then in the church, it's hard for men to relate because a lot of times seminaries are modeled after the academia, which is growing more and more emasculated in a sense. And again, I'm not saying it's a problem to have the presence of the feminine. I married a woman. I love to have the presence of the feminine. But the lack, emasculization, i.e. the removal of the masculine, and then priests, they're unaware that they're coming out of 7 years of formation unable to relate to men. I'm not saying you, Father. I'm saying, but this is a problem. And then the women are in more and more control. I now hear poor stories of principals locking heads trying to lead a school, and the PTA has got some really mothers that are kind of taking control from you. But I mean, this is a problem. The realm of the mother is being extended, and then the growth of the state exponentially is what? A nanny state. And the growth of technology and comfort tends towards being feminine. I can't help but notice that all of the little voices that tell us where to go are all feminine voices. Siri, whatever, all of them are feminine voices, because I think there's a comfort in, they're just telling me where I should go. They've been telling me where I should go my whole life. I'm serious, I really think we need to get about the GPS. You need to associate, you need to orient yourself in the world, learn north and south, and figure out where the hell you are on your own. Unless we're traveling, it's okay, Dave, who's got the GPS when we're driving with Coach. I'm just saying, you don't expect a man to come in and they're like, you knew you were supposed to turn left back there, right? Like, are you kidding me? There's almost a sense that the male voice would be condemning. The female voice is comforting. It just tells me where I should go and when I should be there. It's okay you missed that turn. You can do a U-turn up here. Don't worry. Take the next left. If it was a masculine voice, it's like, never mind, I'm done. You're not listening anyway. Here's the directions. Good luck, you know? So there is not a separation from the feminine. And then, okay, then there's the initiation period. I think that's relatively equal. Just take them camping. Damn, just go somewhere. Into the wild is really simple. Just get out in the woods and go hunting or come down. We have St. Joseph's Farm. We host retreats with fathers and sons, and we split wood, we cut wood, we split wood, we kill a pig, we smoke the pig all night, and we eat the pig, and it's life-changing. And they do it with their dads, and they're all... But we also make it beautiful. This is not an act of domination. We actually read the poem by Wendell Berry on the hog killing. If you haven't read, it's beautiful. May the act of hogs becoming men and never the reverse continue. It's beautiful. So anyway, there's things we can do. That's an easy part. And tell them who, and then the identity giving part of the rite of passage of the initiation is tell your sons you love them. We hear every time the Father speaks in the Gospels, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Just use some words, men. Take your son camping and tell him you love him for God's sake and your own and his. All right, that's a relatively easy part. The next part, though, that's extremely difficult, and that this is why I think Fraternus has had an accidental success, which we didn't manufacture this. It happened by accident. Is all we're doing is giving men a shared identity that allows them to incorporate. Because the fact of the matter that men do not feel incorporated as men, specifically in the church right now. The men's movement is both a great thing and a rebuke to the church. The fact that men have to meet separate from the church in order to feel like men is a wildly huge problem. It reveals the fact that men in Christianity as it exists need men's group. Islam doesn't need men's groups. Most Eastern religions, including Eastern Christianity, do not need men's groups. This is a Western movement because it's a Western problem. We're refusing to recognize the fact that religion has predominantly and always been in the realm of men, because we're priests, naturally, and only in Western Christianity is it now the purview of the women, with some few exceptions. Primarily in the East and in other cultures and societies, it's of course the men go out and offer the sacrifice. Of course they do. What are you talking about? So our biggest challenge is the separation from the other and the fact that we don't have cohesive bodies to be incorporated into. So you might take your son, initiate him, dunk him into that, and then what? You've killed his ego and he's not an individual. What, then it's you and him? The family is not a perfect society. The family is the beginning of society, the church teaches, but the church also teaches, is not a perfect society, meaning it can't reach its full ends. The way we know that is if your daughter is called to marriage, she can't marry within the family. There is a requirement of outside communion with the family, because the state is a perfect society, the church is a perfect society, the family is the basis of both, but it's not a perfect society, because she needs both. That was a big mental dump, I'm sorry. But does that make any sense? Okay. So you need other men. Fathers and sons are the most important relationship, but not the last one. Once I initiate my son, he needs a belonging outside of me. He needs mentors, whose primary job in the Catholic setting is to affirm what I've already taught him and to give him other flavors and images of us. That's what he's doing when he's mentoring. So what are we doing when we're mentoring? In Fraternus, you don't have to understand all these stages perfectly. What actually happens is just masculine space. Where the boys enter, so the way we start Fraternus, a lot of people go, hey, we're here to fix the boys. I'm like, boys aren't the problem. We got to reach the youth. What do you mean reach the youth? You know where they live, you know where they go to school, you know where they go to church. If you can't reach them, you can't reach anybody, okay? The problem is they can't reach us. There is no recognizable, attractive, worthwhile path into manhood for Catholic boys, or else they'd be becoming Catholic men. So what do? They sever themselves from this meaningless, according to them, meaningless church, and they leave, and they don't become individuals. They're not rebels. They join another group. They start dressing like someone else. They join a community. What are all the battles right now over LGBT community, the black community, this community? It's even now the gamer community. Boys playing video games have a community. Everyone is trying to belong to a body. The fact that the church is not providing a meaningful body to belong to is scandalous, and that a gamer community is a substitute for the body of Christ? And it is. They're on video games having adventures, shooting stuff, buddying up with their buddies. That's all artificial. I'm not proposing it. Good grief. Put away the things of a child. But at least what they're doing is imitating but they're not getting that. And then they go to the co-ed confirmation prep in their adolescence, and they make clay models of their feelings and are told to basically be nice, and that this is the extent of Catholic masculinity. Are you kidding me? Slap the boy! Sorry, you know, the right used to slap him. A sort of act of violence as you get your new name, right? That made total logical sense. Bishop Winsky in Miami still slaps him. Can I make one last point and then? Okay. So I just want to tie this again. I really, really would like 15 more minutes, but I can't. I'm not going to ask for that. No, it's okay. I want to tie this. Jesus is in the gospel. The Jesus's rite of passage is very clear. The reason, and I just want to point out, if you want to look at Luke 2, I'm just going to read it out loud and see if you recognize it. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. That's verse 40. Just so you know, that's the same way Luke ends the narrative of John the Baptist's infancy. It's the same way he ends the infancy narrative. So he's obviously bringing Jesus' infancy narrative to an end. He's doing the same thing. But then we get a new narrative, which is his transition into manhood. Now, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of Passover. And when he was 12 years old, traditional age for initiation, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. Separation. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be in the company, they went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. After 3 days, symbol of death, they found him in the temple, resurrected, sitting with the men. They saw him and were astonished, and his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been looking." Mary's taking the initiative. "Where were you? I'm supposed to be keeping an eye on you. How is it that you sought me? Did you not know I must be in my father's house?" Here's the transition to the realm of the father right here in this age. "And they did not understand the saying which he spoke. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. And Mary kept all these things in her heart." This is that phrase is repeated in Luke when she receives the word in his infancy. And then the second time when she receives the reality of his masculine journey, which will be under the realm of the father. She keeps these things in her heart. And then verse 52, "And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature." Luke, every time he has said Jesus prior to this verse, says boy Jesus or infant Jesus. Once he makes this transition is when Luke begins using "and Jesus." And what does he do? "Increase in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man." So Jesus' rite of passage is pretty clear. If you're ever like, why do we have this one episode when he's 12? Well, I don't want to give one interpretation, but there's a very clear reason. This is when Jesus' mission became with the Father. It wasn't necessarily just the cross, because we could get 18 more years with Joseph and Mary. But he's still, "I'm now in my Father. Didn't you not know I best to be about my father's business? I'm not going to sit in your lap forever." Also, last thing, I wish we could have broken that out more, because that's exciting. And it's really cool. The sacraments of initiation, that's what the church calls the revival of the catechumenate was supposed to be that we understand all of Christian life is towards this. Like as 1 Peter says, to grow up into salvation, to put away childish things. That the sacraments of initiation for adults are meant to mature them into adult, the perfect stature of the man, Jesus Christ. And the sacraments of initiation follow von Knepp's thing, which I think he's recognizing a truth. He didn't invent it, but the church, of course, in God's revelation, he's going to work within our humanity. Baptism, "Do you not know that you who have been baptized have been baptized into the death of Christ?" Baptism is partly a bath, but it's primarily a tomb and a womb. You know, and it's hard when we sprinkle that we don't get the full effect, but it's, "I baptize you in the name of the..." And then it's the Son. It's a death. It's a submersion into the tomb. Pope Benedict and Jesus of Nazareth, when Jesus goes down into the waters, this is a descent into the tomb. So baptismal waters are first a tomb of death before they're a womb of resurrection. Because again, that reborn is a rite of passage. You must be reborn again, because these two realities can't exist. The old Adam and the new Adam can't be in the same man. That's why our tussle, when he tries to come back up, we got to rebaptize him. You know. The next one is the next stage initiation, confirmation, is sort of a completion of the baptism promises, where traditionally we would get new names. In the case of the West, I know they did this in the East as infants. But initiation is sort of the full completion of "this is who you are." And then incorporation. The catechism is replete with using the language of the Eucharist as the point of unity, where you are incorporated into the body of Christ. That's actually the language used in the catechism in most documents, that to receive the Eucharist to be in. So we've got the death, we've got the initiation, and before there used to be a little slap in that initiation, I wish that was still there. And then there's the ongoing incorporation into the body of Christ. So that when we all went to Mass today, and we walked out, we belonged to one another when we left. And until we start feeling that in a brotherly way, we can't really do anything for mentoring our sons. So I hope I didn't put this context in too much of what are the nitty-gritties of mentoring. We can maybe get into that over lunch and question and answer. But the point is, we've got to bring boys out of their boyhood and into their manhood. That is the point of mentoring and initiation.
I love it. Great job. Don't go anywhere. We're going to do Q&A.
We're gonna go to quarter after. We're gonna take 10 minutes, and then we'll have some more time. But I don't want you to go anywhere. So beautiful presentation. I'm really glad I recommended Jason to be a part of this because you nailed it. So obviously a lot there. Questions, areas that you might want to take what you're thinking. I wrote down a few things so I could help if need be. But I'd really prefer you to ask Jason. And Jason's not going to be with us tomorrow, so he's going to stick around for the rest of the summit today. But his flight is at 8 o'clock tonight. So please take advantage of your time with him. He's got to get back to milk the cows, you know. So we talk about the formation of the boy and dad leading by example. So questions. Go ahead. And repeat the question if you could.
Okay.
I read a case study once where this young man was involved with pornography and all kinds of other things. And he didn't have a really good relationship with his father and his uncles and whatnot. And the bottom line, the person who was writing this or speaking about it said that this troubled young man was never invited into his masculinity. I never heard that statement before, and in anything else that I read. And I'm wondering what your take is on that.
Yeah, that's. I think what they're describing is what I just took an hour to say. That a boy has been a boy his entire life, and he is the natural state of adolescence is insecurity, and that's okay, because he cannot be secure in something he has never been. So a man must say, come, join me. You are one of me. You're one of us. So to be invited in some way into the world of men, is exactly what's lacking. And the connection to pornography is true. It's just there's multifaceted reasons for that. But one of the best ways out of pornography is to be invited into a group of men that are mutually admitting of their struggle and willing to do shared ascetics and fasting and prayer together and be accountable. So in a sense, we're inviting them, you know, in. But yeah, what they're saying, to be invited into your masculinity, that's what a rite of passage does. That's why fraternity is very frustrating for me to hear people. They want advice on how to form their boys, but the boys are just rarely the problem. If the men are charting a recognizable path and intentionally inviting the boys into it, you don't have a problem with boys. I mean, I get a lot of vocations directors calling, because what they're really struggling with these days is by the time this adolescent gets to the seminary, he's still an adolescent. And they have to start at kind of basic masculinity. If the seminary is wise, a lot of them don't deal with this fact, the sort of formation of the person. But if they're able to have a natural foundation of masculinity, they're able to discern the supernatural masculinity of the priesthood. Sorry, that's a long answer, but yes, they need to be invited. That's what an initiation does. It's not us looking at drinking beer, sitting back while the boy does something really hard. It's us inviting him into our world. That's why we have to have a world of brotherhood together first to invite him into it.
Great question. If you could repeat it just so it's clear.
He told me to repeat it, and I didn't. The question was, in a story about a young man being addicted to pornography, it was pointed out that he was never invited into masculinity. So is that related to what I'm talking about? And the answer is yes, because the invitation is the rite of passage. It's initiated by the man, not the boy, and not the woman.
Very good. So maybe a bit of a follow-up. Like, I'm still struggling a little bit on in the incorporation part. So I work for a large corporation, and my oldest son's 12, and I'm thinking about now.
You better be.
I wish I could invite him into, you're going to come watch your father work, but it's not possible, right? So you talk about having to manufacture almost these experiences. So I don't know what to invite him into, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I cut you off.
No, so.
You're articulating, everywhere I've ever spoken and taught about mentoring, you are articulating the problem, which I'll repeat in the microphone, is I work in a corporation, I work in an office. I could be a man or a woman doing what I do, and it's not a work I can share. Come look at my computer screen with me. It's not a work I can share with them. So it is no longer a means of initiation, which yes, work has been for a long time our primary means of initiation, in the West especially. So even knighthood is modeled after the guilds of the Middle Ages and the ceremonies they would go through to once a apprentice reached master's level, which is where we get the master's degree, where he reached master's level, then I would have a ceremony to bestow the tools of the trade on him. You don't have that. You're void of that, and that's a huge challenge. So I can only give recommendations because this is the angst that's only ours. No other than those who have been violently stripped by, like, you know, the violence of the communists against peoples or the Nazis. We're the only ones that have had a self-inflicted destruction of our culture. Other ones have been ripped from them. But the benefit of having a persecution is that you want to go back and recover your traditions. We're still rebelling against our traditions. Mm. So we're in a unique situation. I would say I did just finish a book on this. If you could pray that the publishers would get with it. My recommendations are, one, that he has some sort of intentional masculine formation. The fact that you can't do it at work means you have to do it somewhere else. So if he's in a lot of groups that make him too busy to be with you and other men, then he should quit those groups because they're probably childish. And you have to have an encounter with real things, because if not, your words will be too heavy. You'll have too many words. You're trying to say too much, and he's not witnessing. He needs to be kind of accompanying you in something. He will recognize it as, you're just one of the everyone else in the world trying to download the data of what you think I should be into my mind. Whereas if you can experience something in reality, so you could come kill a pig with me if you'd like, but doing things with him and maybe your friends, it doesn't have to be a huge group. If you have three friends, which even today that can be rare, go somewhere together as just men and then go somewhere together with your sons. Do that. I think that, this is what's great about fraternists, and you don't have to do fraternist things like it, but something ongoing where the men and the boys are together for natural and spiritual formation at the same time, as men. So those elements, you have those, but yeah, you don't have your work, and you don't have a cohesive culture that's friendly to your masculinity. So be careful not to manufacture and be artificial, but I don't think it's that hard. Real things, real people, real stuff.
And Justin wouldn't share, but his kids are in the Boy Scouts with him. He's a scout master with them, or leader. And also, you've done a lot of scouting on your own. So I think a lot of the stuff you already got in place.
Yeah.
And your chickens at your home, their daily duties with them.
Yeah, livestock is great because it's real responsibility. If you don't feed them, they die, you know.
Yeah. So you're doing a lot, Justin.
Yeah. No, you're right. But there is still that danger of too much talking, not enough action. Like that really resonated.
Yeah, I tend towards. I do it to my kids. We live on a farm. I'll sit there and start a lecture. I'm like, never mind. Let's go. You know, let's go do something. We'll talk later. You know.
All right. How about one more question before lunch, and then of course the dialogue can continue. But very rich. Anybody else? I have a question, and no one wants to take the floor. Anybody? I don't want to take over. All right, I was really impressed and inspired, and it's the first time I actually heard the language this way, killing the ego. I mean, I get the ego thing, but so talk, if you could, where does this come from, this in the rite of passage, this idea of killing the ego, and why has it been lost? Like, why in the culture, and you spoke to it to a degree, in the culture, what happened that accentuated the ego? I think I have my ideas on that one, but and really squash this self-denial stuff.
So I think we should say in society and in society of the church.
Right. So where does it come from, and why did it disappear? The notion of that.
Because the necessity of killing the ego, probably, is as far as the cultural reality of not having a work, not having acceptable places in society that require the death of the ego, like everyone understanding themselves as in the military. If everyone sort of understand, we collectively have to be a part of this. There's a great book, if you want to, called Tribe by Sebastian Younger, who he's a book. He actually wrote, it's about post-traumatic stress syndrome. And he says, primarily, it's the post-traumatic stress syndrome is not primarily shell shock, but the fact that men go from a mission-oriented, sacrificial reality to a narcissistic society that they don't actually... So they come home, and actually what they say is, I wasn't actually fighting for these people. I was really fighting for my unit, because these people wouldn't fight for me. and that shock of having no belonging. So our greatest sort of intellectual error, which has burst forth in our society, is we live for ourselves. And we are told self-gratification. The whole idea, what we're doing is reversing a rite of passage. So transgenderism, for example, when I say you have to kill the ego in order to be a part of the body, we're doing the opposite. The body has to die to their how they perceive my gender so that the individual can have what they want. So we are dissolving constantly bodies of existing institutions so that the individual can be more and more autonomous and absolute. So it's because our individualism post the Protestant Revolution tended towards individualism, me and Jesus, me and my Bible. And then the Enlightenment tended towards liberty, i.e., and we have this in our American blood, i.e., the full and absolute autonomy of the individual. The sexual revolution, the one place where your self gratification had some sort of connection with self gift, because I really liked it, but then a child came, so I got to kind of connect these. Post sexual revolution contraception allows me to completely turn in on myself. And then now I think in the technological revolution we're dealing with, it's a full extension of the ego where I am actually in a constant state of projecting the self onto the world and assessing how the self is being, and I'm adjusting self constantly because people aren't actually having to look me in the eye. I'm able to lie really easily to Twitter, and I'm constantly inventing the self. So it makes the self the center. No wonder. I mean, when I was in high school, it wasn't that long ago, it would have been shameful to take a picture of yourself. And now the idea of selfie, the selfie is the icon of the modern age. It's the self being presented to the world. It's just me and myself taking a picture of myself, reading myself magazine, working on myself. I want to sign in and see what myself said about myself earlier. It's an absurdity. And then within the church, we have been battling Protestantism for so long that we have individualized a lot of our spirituality. As De Lubac put it, he was working off Kierkegaard here, I'm not sure, trying to correct him, but we went from love one another, the command that is riddled through the New Testament, to save your soul, which is individualization. But 1 John, he just said, the only way you know you've saved your soul, you've moved from death to life, is that you're actually living for your brother. But now we actually consider our spiritual lives largely autonomous from one another. And I think our shared asceticism in the last century was lost. We went from about 43 to 50, depending on rogation days and things, of shared days of fasting to only two within one generation. So we don't have shared ego killing. Wow. That's the point. And that most of this intellectually within Theology of the Church, a book by Joseph Ratzinger called The Meaning of Christian Brotherhood. And he talks about brotherhood is the primary identity of the Christian. And the primary barrier, therefore, is the ego. So the point of asceticism fasting is to kill the ego so as to be a part of the body. So when the self comes up, it's not that you and yourself are struggling, and your cell, and oh, aren't you just a desert father? No, it's that you're selfish, and therefore unable to give the gift of yourself to the other. When we teach virtue and fraternity, it's like you're not gaining virtue so you can walk around with like prudence on your chest. I mean, this is absurd. You want to possess yourself in virtue, and this is where Augustine corrects any kind of pagan error in the idea of virtue. You possess yourself in virtue so that you can give it away. Why else would you be possessing yourself? Whereas the pagan vision of virtue is, I possess myself because it's beautiful. But no, if you don't find the outlet of the self-gift, your virtue is kind of the pious version of masturbation. You don't find the outlet that's appropriate to being life-giving. So in a sense, I know that sounds really funny, but I consider that our piety is almost like pious masturbation. It's all about us and doesn't find an outlet in a life-giving way.
Wow. There's a whole treatise. That was good. No, I love it.
We hope you enjoy this recording from our Masculine Genius Institute Summit. This institute was founded through the collaborative effort of the King's Men and the Men's Academy. For more information and for other resources, you can visit their website at thekingsmen.org and themensacademy.org. Thank you.